omelet in half. You could come, you know, Ren said. Kath snorted. When she glanced up again, Ren looked upset. What? Kath said. I'm not arguing with you. I assumed you were doing something with her this week. Ren clenched her jaw so tight, her cheeks pulsed. I can't believe you're making me do this alone. Kath held up the spatula between them. Making you? I'm not making you do anything. I can't believe you're even doing this when you know how much I hate it. Ren shoved off the counter, shaking her head. Oh, you hate everything. You hate change. If I didn't drag you along behind me, you'd never get anywhere. Well, you're not dragging me anywhere tomorrow, Kath said, turning away from the stove. Or anywhere from now on. You are hereby released of all responsibility, re-dragging me along. Ren folded her arms and tilted her head, the sanctimonious one. Why? Kath tried really hard to say it without whining. Because, Ren hitched up her backpack. Because she's our mom, and I'm thinking about it. But it wasn't that Kath couldn't think of an argument. It was that there were so many. The arguments in her brain were like a swarm of people running from a burning building and getting stuck in the door. But she'll just mess everything up. Too much. I'm not sure I'm even going to finish Carry On. Of course you'll finish. She looked up at him sharply. I've only got 9 days left. Levi still seemed confused, and maybe a little hurt. You've got 12 days left until the end of the semester, and about 14 before I go back to Arnold, but as far as I can tell, you've got the rest of your life to finish Carry On. Kath felt her face go hard. You don't understand, she said, at all. So explain it to me. Simon Snow and the Eighth Dance comes out in 9 days. Levi shrugged. So? So I've been working 2 years toward this.
Toward finishing Carry On?
Yes, and I have to finish before the series ends.
Why? Did Gemma Leslie challenge you to a race?
Kath jammed the knotted power cord into her bag. You don't understand. Levi sighed.
All the monster, reaching out to its own kind, the way it had when she was slipping away, slowly suffocating under the snow. She remembered that bizarre moment when her mind had shimmied, stepped away, and how then she'd seen a field of snow and broken trees and rocks and a ski-pole. My God, that wasn't the bright light at the end of the tunnel. I was in Wolf's head again. He was looking for me after the avalanche, trying to figure out where I was under the snow. That was the only explanation for why she was alive. When she'd passed out for that final time, only minutes from death, the monster had slipped its noose, oiling out in black tendrils, because like seeks like. "What do you want from me?" her voice quaked. Leopard's knife wobbled, and she clutched with both hands to steady it. She was hunched over, very cold now, trembling uncontrollably. Her hair hung in icy clots, although her parka was dry. How could that be? Her clothes were still wet. Wait a minute. Her breath hung in her throat. My parka was sopping wet. How can it? Her gaze drifted to her right arm, and she saw immediately why this parka was dry. The color, gunmetal gray, was wrong. It was also too large, the cuff loose around her wrist. The coat puffed out from her chest and was clearly intended for someone much bigger and more muscular. The parka actually reminded her of
embarrassment or even boredom. But the mere word afraid had let the cat out of the bag. I realized now that my emotion was neither more nor less nor other than fear. And I realized that I was afraid of two things. Afraid that sooner or later I myself might meet an Eldil, and afraid that I might get drawn in. I suppose everyone knows this fear of getting drawn in, the moment at which a man realizes that what had seemed mere speculations are on the point of landing him in the Communist Party or the Christian Church. The sense that a door has just slammed and left him on the inside. The thing was such sheer bad luck. Ransom himself had been taken to Mars or Malacandra against his will and almost by accident, and I had become connected with his affair by another accident. Yet here we were, both getting more and more involved in what I could only describe as interplanetary politics. As to my intense wish never to come into contact with the Eldila myself, I am not sure whether I can make you understand it. It was something more than a prudent desire to avoid creatures alien in kind, very powerful and very intelligent. The truth was that all I heard about them served to connect two things which one's mind tends to keep separate, and that connecting gave one a sort of shock. We tend to think about non-human intelligences in two distinct categories, which we label scientific and supernatural, respectively. We think, in one mood, of Mr. Wells's Martians, very unlike the real Malacandrians, by the by, or his Selenites. In quite a different mood, we let our minds loose on the possibility of angels, ghosts, fairies, and the like. But the very moment we are compelled to recognize a creature in either class as real, the distinction begins to get blurred. And when it is a creature like an Eldil, the distinction vanishes altogether. These things were not animals. To that extent, one had to classify them with the second group. But they had some kind of material vehicle whose presence could, in principle, be scientifically verified. To that extent, they belonged to the first group. The distinction between natural and supernatural, in fact, broke down. And when it had done so, one realized how great a comfort it had been, how it had eased the burden of intolerable strangeness which this universe imposes on us by dividing it into two halves and encouraging the mind never to think of both in the same context. What price we may have paid for this comfort, in the way of false security and accepted confusion of thought, is another matter. This is a long, dreary road, I thought to myself. Thank goodness I haven't anything to carry. And then, with a start of realization, I remembered that I ought to be carrying a pack containing my things for the night. I swore to myself, I must have left the thing in the train. Will you believe me when I say that my immediate impulse was to turn back to the station and do something about it? Of course, there was nothing to be done, which could not equally well be done by ringing up from the cottage. That train, with my pack in it, must by this time be miles away. I realize that now as clearly as you do, but at the moment it seemed perfectly obvious that I must retrace my steps, and I had indeed begun to do so before reason or conscience awoke and set me once more plodding forwards. In doing this, I discovered more clearly than before how very little I wanted to do it. It was such hard work that I felt as if I were walking against a headwind. But in fact, it was one of those still, dead evenings when no twig stirs, and beginning to be a little foggy. The farther I went, the more impossible I found it to think about anything except these Eldila. What, after all, did Ransom really know about them? By his own account, the sorts which he had met did not usually visit our own planet, or had only begun to do so since his return from Mars. We had Eldila of our own, he said, Tellurian Eldils, but they were of a different kind and mostly hostile to man. That, in fact, was why our world was cut off from communication with the other planets. He described us as being in a state of siege, as being, in fact, an enemy-occupied territory held down by Eldils who were at war both with us and with the Eldils of deep heaven or space. Like the bacteria on the microscopic level, so these co-inhabiting pests on the macroscopic permeate our whole life invisibly, and are the real explanation of that fatal bent which is the main lesson of history. If all this were true, then of course we should welcome the fact that Eldila of a better kind had at last broken the frontier. It is, they say, at the moon's orbit, and were beginning to visit us, always assuming that Ransom's account was the correct one. A nasty idea occurred to me. Why should not Ransom be a dupe? If something from outer space were trying to invade our planet, what better smokescreen could it put up than this very story of Ransom's? Was there the slightest evidence, after all, for the existence of the supposed maleficent Eldils on this earth? How if my friend were the unwitting bridge, the Trojan horse, whereby some possible invader were effecting its landing on Tellus? And then once more, just as when I had discovered that I had no pack, the impulse to go no farther returned to me. Go back, it whispered to me. Send him a wire, tell him you were ill, say you'll come some other time, anything. The strength of the feeling astonished me. I stood still for a few moments, telling myself not to be a fool. and when I finally resumed my walk, I was wondering whether this might be the beginning of a nervous breakdown. No sooner had this idea occurred to me than it also became a new reason for not visiting Ransom. Obviously, I wasn't fit for any such jumpy business as his telegram almost certainly referred to. I wasn't even fit to spend an ordinary weekend away from home. My only sensible course was to turn back at once and get safe home, before I lost my memory or became hysterical, and to put myself in the hands of a doctor. It was sheer madness to go on. I was now coming to the end of the heath and going down a small hill, with a copse on my left and some apparently deserted industrial buildings on my right. At the bottom the evening mist was partly thick. They call it a breakdown at first, I thought. Wasn't there some mental disease in which quite ordinary objects looked to the patient unbelievably ominous? Looked, in fact, just as that abandoned factory looks to me now? Great bulbous shapes of cement, strange brickwork bogies, glowered at me over dry scrubby grass pockmarked with grey pools and intersected with the remains of a light railway. I was reminded of things which Ransom had seen in that other world. Only there they were people, long spindle-like giants whom he called Sorns. What made it worse was that he regarded them as good people, very much nicer, in fact, than our own race. He was in league with them. How did I know he was even a dupe? He might be something worse, and again I came to a standstill. The reader, not knowing Ransom, will not understand how contrary to all reason this idea was. The rational part of my mind, even at that moment, knew perfectly well that even if the whole universe were crazy and hostile, Ransom was sane and wholesome and honest. And this part of my mind in the end sent me forward, but with a reluctance and a difficulty I can hardly put into words. What enabled me to go on was the knowledge, deep down inside me, that I was getting nearer at every stride to the one friend. But I felt that I was getting nearer to the one enemy, the traitor, the sorcerer, the man in league with them, walking into the trap with my eyes open like a fool. "They call it a breakdown at first," said my mind, "and send you to a nursing home. Later on they move you to an asylum." I was past the dead factory now, down in the fog, where it was very cold. Then came a moment, the first one, of absolute terror, and I had to bite my lips to keep myself from screaming. It was only a cat that had run across the road, but I found myself completely unnerved. "Soon you will really be screaming," said my inner tormentor, "running round and round screaming, and you won't be able to stop it." There was a little empty house by the side of the road, with most of the windows boarded up and one staring like the eye of a dead fish. Please understand that at ordinary times the idea of a haunted house means no more to me than it does to you. No more, but also no less. At that moment it was nothing so definite as the thought of a ghost that came to me. It was just the word haunted. Haunted. Haunting. What a quality there is in that first syllable. Would not a child who had never heard the word before and did not know its meaning shudder at the mere sound if, as the day was closing in, it heard one of its elders say to another, "This house is haunted"? At last I came to the crossroads by the little Wesleyan chapel where I had to turn to the left under the beech trees. I ought to be seeing the lights from Ransom's windows by now, or was it past blackout time? My watch had stopped and I didn't know. It was dark enough, but that might be due to the fog and the trees. It wasn't the dark I was afraid of, you understand. We have all known times when inanimate objects seemed to have almost a facial expression, and it was the expression of this bit of road which I did not like. "It's not true," said my mind, "that people who are really going mad never think they're going mad. Suppose that real insanity had chosen this place in which to begin. In that case, of course, the black enmity of those dripping trees, their horrible expectancy, would be a hallucination. But that did not make it any better. To think that the spectre you see is an illusion does not rob him of his terrors. It simply adds the further terror of madness itself. And then, on top of that, the horrible surmise that those whom the rest call mad have, all along, been the only people who see the world as it really is." This was upon me now. I staggered on into the cold and the darkness, already half convinced that I must be entertaining what is called madness. But each moment my opinion about sanity changed. Had it ever been more than a convention, a comfortable set of blinkers, an agreed mode of wishful thinking, which excluded from our view the full strangeness and malevolence of the universe we are compelled to inhabit? The things I had begun to know during the last few months of my acquaintance with Ransom already amounted to more than sanity would admit. But I had come much too far to dismiss them as unreal. I doubted his interpretation or his good faith. I did not doubt the existence of the things he had met in Mars, the Fifeltrigi, the Hrossa, and the Sorns, nor of these interplanetary Eldela. I did not even doubt the reality of that mysterious being whom the Eldela call Maleldil, and to whom they appear to give a total obedience such as no Tellurian dictator can command. I knew what Ransom supposed Maleldil to be. Surely that was the cottage. It was very well blacked out. A childish, whining thought arose on my mind. Why was he not out at the gate to welcome me? An even more childish thought followed it. Perhaps he was in the garden, waiting for me, hiding. Perhaps he would jump on me from behind. Perhaps I should see a figure that looked like Ransom standing with its back to me, and when I spoke to it, it would turn round and show a face that was not human at all. I have naturally no wish to enlarge on this phase of my story. The state of mind I was in was one which I look back on with humiliation. I would have passed it over if I did not think that some account of it was necessary for a full understanding of what follows, and perhaps of some other things as well. At all events, I can't really describe how I reached the front door of the cottage. Somehow or other, despite the loathing and dismay that pulled me back and a sort of invisible wall of resistance that met me in the face, fighting for each step and almost shrieking as a harmless spray of the hedge touched my face, I managed to get through the gate and up the little path. And there I was, drumming on the door and wringing the handle and shouting to him to let me in as if my life depended on it. There was no reply. Not a sound except the echo of the sounds I had been making myself. There was only something white fluttering on the knocker. I guessed, of course, that it was a note. In striking a match to read it by, I discovered how very shaky my hands had become. And when the match went out, I realized how dark the evening had grown. After several attempts, I read the thing. "Sorry, had to go up to Cambridge. Shan't be back till the late train. Eatables in larder and bed made up in your usual room. Don't wait supper for me unless you feel like it. E.R." And immediately the impulse to retreat, which had already assailed me several times, leaped upon me with a sort of demoniac violence. Here was my retreat left open, positively inviting me. Now was my chance. If anyone expected me to go into that house and sit there alone for several hours, they were mistaken. But then, as the thought of the return journey began to take shape in my mind, I faltered. The idea of setting out to traverse the avenue of beech trees again, it was really dark now, with this house behind me, one had the absurd feeling that it could follow one, was not attractive. And then, I hope, something better came into my mind, some rag of sanity and some reluctance to let Ransom down. At least I could try the door to see if it were really unlocked. I did, and it was. Next moment, I hardly know how, I found myself inside and let it slam behind me. It was quite dark and warm. I groped a few paces forward, hit my shin violently against something, and fell. I sat still for a few seconds, nursing my leg. I thought I knew the layout of Ransom's hall sitting room pretty well, and couldn't imagine what I had blundered into. Presently I groped in my pocket, got out my matches, and tried to strike a light. The head of the match flew off. I stamped on it and sniffed to make sure it was not smouldering on the carpet. As soon as I sniffed, I became aware of a strange smell in the room. I could not for the life of me make out what it was. It had an unlikeness to ordinary domestic smells as great as that of some chemicals, but it was not a chemical kind of smell at all. Then I struck another match. It flickered and went out almost at once, not unnaturally, since I was sitting on the doormat, and there are few front doors even in better-built houses than Ransom's country cottage which do not admit a draught. I had seen nothing by it except the palm of my own hand, hollowed in an attempt to guard the flame. Obviously I must get away from the door. I rose gingerly and felt my way forward. I came at once to an obstacle, something smooth and very cold that rose a little higher than my knees. As I touched it, I realized that it was the source of the smell. I groped my way along this to the left and finally came to the end of it. It seemed to present several surfaces, and I couldn't picture the shape. It was not a table, for it had no top. One's hand groped along the rim of a kind of low wall, the thumb on the outside and the fingers down inside the enclosed space. If it had felt like wood, I should have supposed it to be a large packing case. But it was not wood. I thought for a moment that it was wet, but soon decided that I was mistaking coldness for moisture. When I reached the end of it, I struck my third match. I saw something white and semi-transparent, rather like ice. A great big thing, very long, a kind of box, an open box, and of a disquieting shape which I did not immediately recognize. It was big enough to put a man into. Then I took a step back, lifting the lighted match higher to get a more comprehensive view, and instantly tripped over something behind me. I found myself sprawling in darkness, not on the carpet, but on more of the cold substance with the odd smell. How many of the infernal things were there? I was just preparing to rise again and hunt systematically round the room for a candle when I heard Ransom's name pronounced. And almost, but not quite simultaneously, I saw the thing I had feared so long to see. I heard Ransom's name pronounced. But I should not like to say I heard a voice pronounce it. The sound was quite astonishingly unlike a voice. It was perfectly articulate. It was even, I suppose, rather beautiful. But it was, if you understand me, inorganic. We feel the difference between animal voices, including those of the human animal, and all other noises pretty clearly, I fancy, though it is hard to define. Blood and lungs and the warm, moist cavity of the mouth are somehow indicated in every voice. Here they were not. The two syllables sounded more as if they were played on an instrument than as if they were spoken. And yet they did not sound mechanical, either. A machine is something we make out of natural materials. This was more as if rock or crystal or light had spoken of itself. And it went through me from chest to groin like the thrill that goes through you when you think you have lost your hold while climbing a cliff. That was what I heard. What I saw was very simply a faint rod or pillar of light. I don't think it made a circle of light either on the floor or the ceiling, but I am not sure of this. It certainly had very little power of illuminating its surroundings. So far, all is plain sailing. But it had two other characteristics which are less easy to grasp. One was its colour. Since I saw the thing, I must obviously have seen it either white or coloured, but no efforts of my memory can conjure up the faintest image of what that colour was. I try blue and gold and violet and red, but none of them will fit. How it is possible to have a visual experience which immediately and ever after becomes impossible to remember, I do not attempt to explain. The other was its angle. It was not at right angles to the floor, but as soon as I have said this, I hasten to add that this way of putting it is a later reconstruction. What one actually felt at the moment was that the column of light was vertical, but the floor was not horizontal. The whole room seemed to have heeled over as if it were on board ship. The impression, however produced, was that this creature had reference to some horizontal, to some whole system of directions based outside the earth, and that its mere presence imposed that alien system on me and abolished the terrestrial horizontal. I had no doubt at all that I was seeing an Eldil, and little doubt that I was seeing the Archon of Mars, the Oyarsa of Malakandra. And now that the thing had happened, I was no longer in a condition of abject panic. My sensations were, it is true, in some ways very unpleasant. The fact that it was quite obviously not organic, the knowledge that intelligence was somehow located in this homogeneous cylinder of light, but not related to it as our consciousness is related to our brains and nerves, was profoundly disturbing. Note, in the text I naturally keep to what I thought and felt at the time, since this alone is first-hand evidence. But there is obviously room for much further speculation about the form in which Eldila appear to our senses. The only serious considerations of the problem so far are to be sought in the early 17th century. As a starting point for future investigation, I recommend the following from Natvilsius. De Aetherio et Aereo Corpore, Baal, 1627, 2, 12. Liquet simplicem flammam sensibus nostris subjectam non esse corpus propriae dictum angeli vel demonis. Sed potius aut ilius corporis sensorium, aut superficient corporis in coelesti dispositione locorum supra cogitationes humanas existentis. It appears that the homogeneous flame perceived by our senses is not the body, properly so called, of an angel or demon, but rather a manner beyond our conception in the celestial frame of special references. By the celestial frame of references, I take him to mean what we should now call multidimensional space. Not, of course, that Natvilsius knew anything about multidimensional geometry, but that he had reached empirically what mathematics has since reached on theoretical grounds. It would not fit into our categories. The response which we ordinarily make to a living creature and that which we make to an inanimate object were here both equally inappropriate. On the other hand, all those doubts which I had felt before I entered the cottage as to whether these creatures were friend or foe, and whether Ransom were a pioneer or a dupe, had for the moment vanished. My fear was now of another kind. I felt sure that the creature was what we call good, but I wasn't sure whether I liked goodness so much as I had supposed. This is a very terrible experience. As long as what you are afraid of is something evil, you may still hope that the good may come to your rescue. But suppose you struggle through to the good and find that it also is dreadful. How if food itself turns out to be the very thing you can't eat, and home the very place you can't live, and your very comforter the person who makes you uncomfortable? Then indeed there is no rescue possible. The last card has been played. For a second or two I was nearly in that condition. Here at last was a bit of that world from beyond the world which I had always supposed that I loved and desired, breaking through and appearing to my senses. And I didn't like it. I wanted it to go away. I wanted every possible distance, gulf, curtain, blanket, and barrier to be placed between it and me. But I did not fall quite into the gulf. Oddly enough, my very sense of helplessness saved me and steadied me. For now I was quite obviously drawn in. The struggle was over. The next decision did not lie with me. Then, like a noise from a different world, came the opening of the door and the sound of boots on the doormat, and I saw, silhouetted against the greyness of the night in the open doorway, a figure which I recognized as Ransom. The speaking, which was not a voice, came again out of the rod of light, and Ransom, instead of moving, stood still and answered it. Both speeches were in a strange polysyllabic language which I had not heard before. I make no attempt to excuse the feelings which awoke in me when I heard the unhuman sound addressing my friend and my friend answering it in the unhuman language. They are, in fact, inexcusable. But if you think they are improbable at such a juncture, I must tell you plainly that you have read neither history nor your own heart to much effect. They were feelings of resentment, horror, and jealousy. It was in my mind to shout out, "Leave your familiar alone, you damned magician, and attend to me." What I actually said was, "Oh, Ransom, thank God you've come."
Chapter 2. The door was slammed for the second time that night, and after a moment's groping, Ransom had found and lit a candle. I glanced quickly round and could see no one but ourselves. The most noticeable thing in the room was the big white object. I recognized the shape well enough this time. It was a large coffin-shaped casket, open. On the floor beside it lay its lid, and it was doubtless this that I had tripped over. Both were made of the same white material, like ice, but more cloudy and less shining. "By Jove, I'm glad to see you," said Ransom, advancing and shaking hands with me. "I'd hoped to be able to meet you at the station, but everything has had to be arranged in such a hurry, and I found at the last moment that I'd got to go up to Cambridge. I never intended to leave you to make that journey alone." Then, seeing, I suppose, that I was still staring at him rather stupidly, he added, "I say, you're all right, aren't you? You got through the barrage without any damage?" "The barrage? I don't understand." "I was thinking you would have met some difficulties in getting here." "Oh, that," said I. "You mean it wasn't just my nerves? There really was something in the way?" "Yes. They didn't want you to get here. I was afraid something of the sort might happen, but there was no time to do anything about it. I was pretty sure you'd get through somehow." "By they, you mean the others, our own Eldila?" "Of course. They've got wind of what's on hand." I interrupted him. "To tell you that—"
One of them would stand on her bed and pretend to pull an imaginary lever, a giant switch set in the air, and shout, "Emergency Kanye party!" And then it was the other person's job to run to the computer and start the Emergency Kanye playlist. And then they'd both jump around and dance and shout Kanye West lyrics until they felt better. Sometimes it would take a while. "I'm authorized to call an emergency Kanye party," Kath thought to herself, laughing again. This time it came out slightly more like a laugh. Question was Kath's Achilles heel. She opened the story she'd been reading to him. It was something she'd written last year for a Christmas fic festival, Deck the Halls with Baz and Simon. Kath's fic had won 2 awards, Tastes Like Canon and Best in Snow. "Where did we leave off?" she said, mostly to herself.
Baz's teeth were bared, and his face was filled with disgust and decision.
Kath found the spot in the story. Was she always going to be this stupid? Her whole miserable life? Kath cried until it felt pointless, then stumbled off the bed to get a drink of water. When she opened the door, Levi was sitting in the hallway, his legs bent in front of him, hunched forward on his knees. He looked up when she stepped out.
"I'm such an idiot," he said.
Kath fell between his knees and hugged him.
"I can't believe I said that," he said. "I can't even go 9 hours without seeing you."
"No, you're right," Kath said. "I've been acting crazy. This whole thing is crazy. It isn't even real."
"That's not what I meant. It is real. You have to finish."
"Yeah," she said, kissing his chin, trying to remember where she'd left off. "But not today. You were right. There's time. They'll wait for me." She pushed her hands inside his jacket. He held her by her. "No," Kath said, "because the bipolar bears were really bringing him down."
"Because Rudolph's nose just seemed too bright."
"Because the chimneys make him claustrophobic."
"Because," her dad laughed, "the highs and lows were too much for him. On the sled, get it?"
"That's terrible," Kath said, laughing. Her dad's eyes looked bright, but, "Wow," she said, "good memory." Levi was smiling. He kicked her chair again. "Okay," she said. "So they're in the boat, and Simon is leaning over, looking at the tiles on the moat wall." Levi closed his eyes. Kath cleared her throat. When he looked back, Baz had stepped toward him in the punt. He was curled above Simon, washed blue by his own conjured fire, his teeth bared and his face thick with decision and disgust. Baz held the pole just over Simon's face, and before Simon could reach his wand or whisper a spell, Baz was driving the pole forward over Simon's shoulder. The boat shook, and there was a gurgling howl, a frenzied splash from the water. Baz raised the pole and drove it down again, his face as cold and cruel as Simon had ever seen it. His wide lips were shining, and he was practically growling. Simon held himself still while the boat rocked. When Baz stepped back,
"It's not like I need a quorum."
She reached toward her laptop and opened her Kanye playlist. There were portable speakers in one of her drawers. She got them out and plugged them in. Then she turned the volume all the way up. It was a Friday night. There was nobody in the building. Maybe nobody on campus to disturb. "Emergency Kanye party." Kath climbed onto her bed to announce it, but she stepped right down. It felt silly and pathetic. Is there anything more pathetic than a one-person dance party? She stood in front of the speakers instead and closed her eyes, not really dancing, just bouncing and whispering the lyrics. After the first verse, she was dancing. Kanye always crawled right under her skin. He was the perfect antidote to any serious frustration. Just enough angry, just enough indignant, just enough "the world will never know how ridiculously awesome I am," just enough poet. With her eyes closed, Kath could only, "What are the rules again? No talking about sex, no PDA, no talking about relationship stuff.
No being jealous."
"No being unnecessarily jealous, is that fair?" Reagan pursed her lips.
"All right, but be rational if this comes up. No being unnecessarily jealous."
"And no being a horrible, narcissistic bitch who gets off on her ex-boyfriend's affection. Not too bright." She waited for him to go to bed before she went upstairs. Ren still wasn't home. Kath tried to write, but closed her laptop after 15 minutes of staring at a blank screen. She crawled under her blankets and tried not to think about Ren, tried not to picture her in Laura's new house, with Laura's new family. Kath tried not to think of anything at all. When she cleared her head, she was surprised to find Levi there, underneath all the clutter. Levi in God's country, probably having the merriest Christmas of them all. Merry. That was Levi 365 days a year. On leap years, 366. Levi probably loved leap years. Another day, another girl to kiss. It was a little easier to think about him now that Kath knew she'd never have him, that she'd probably never see him again. She fell asleep thinking about his dirty blonde hair and his overabundant forehead and everything else.
Vacations. I rather fancy I am being sent because those two blackguards who kidnapped me and took me to Malacandra did something which they never intended, namely, gave a human being a chance to learn that language. What language do you mean? Resahlab, of course. The language I learned in Malacandra. Oh, but surely you don't imagine they will speak the same language on Venus. Oh, didn't I tell you about that? Said Ransom, leaning forward. We were now at table and had nearly finished our cold meat and beer and tea. I'm surprised I didn't, for I found out 2 or 3 months ago, and scientifically it is one of the most interesting things about the whole affair. It appears we were quite mistaken in thinking Hresa-Hlab the peculiar speech of Mars. It is really what may be called Old Solar, Hlab Erebol Efkordi. What on earth do you mean? I mean that there was originally a common speech for all rational creatures inhabiting the planets of our system, those that were ever inhabited, I mean, what the Eldils call the Low Worlds. Most of them, of course, have never been inhabited and never will be, at least not what we'd call inhabited. That original speech was lost on Solcandra, our own world, when our whole tragedy took place. No human language now known in the world is descended from it. But what about the other two languages on Mars? I admit I don't understand about them. One thing I do know, and I believe I could prove it on purely philological grounds, they are incomparably less ancient than Hresa-Hlab, especially Sunibur, the speech of the Sorns. I believe it could be shown that Sunibur is, by Malacandrian standards, quite a modern development. I doubt if its birth can be put further back than a date which would fall within our Cambrian period. And you think you will find Hresa-Hlab, or Old Solar, spoken on Venus? Yes, I shall arrive knowing the language. It saves a lot of trouble, though as a philologist I find it rather disappointing. But you've no idea what you are to do, or what conditions you will find. No idea at all what I'm to do. There are jobs, you know, where it is essential that one should not know too much beforehand, things one might have to say which one couldn't say effectively if one had prepared them. As to conditions, well, I don't know much. It will be warm. I'm to go naked. Our astronomers don't know anything about the surface of Perelandra at all. The outer layer of her atmosphere is too thick. The main problem, apparently, is whether she revolves on her own axis or not, and at what speed. There are two schools of thought. There's a man called Schiaparelli who thinks she revolves once on herself in the same time it takes her to go once around Arbol, I mean the sun. The other people think she revolves on her own axis once in every 23 hours. That's one of the things I shall find out. If Schiaparelli is right, there'd be perpetual day on one side of her and perpetual night on the other. He nodded, musing. It'd be a funny frontier, he said presently. Just think of it. You'd come to a country of eternal twilight, getting colder and darker every mile you went, and then presently you wouldn't be able to go further because there'd be no more air. I wonder, can you stand in the day, just on the right side of the frontier, and look into the night, which you can never reach, and perhaps see a star or two? The only place you could see them, for of course in the daylands they would never be visible. Of course, if they have a scientific civilization, they may have diving suits or things like submarines on wheels for going into the night. His eyes sparkled, and even I, who had been mainly thinking of how I should miss him and wondering what chances there were of my ever seeing him again, felt a vicarious thrill of wonder and of longing to know. Presently he spoke again. "You haven't asked me yet where you come in," he said. "Do you mean I'm to go too?" said I, with a thrill of exactly the opposite kind. "Not at all. I mean you are to pack me up and to stand by to unpack me when I return, if all goes well." "Pack you?" Oh, I'd forgotten about that coffin affair. Oh, Ransom, how on earth are you going to travel in that thing? What's the motive power? What about air and food and water? There's only just room for you to lie in it. The Oyasa of Malakandra himself will be the motive power. He will simply move it to Venus. Don't ask me how. I have no idea what organs or instruments they use. But a creature who has kept a planet in its orbit for several billions of years will be able to manage a packing case. But what will you eat? How will you breathe? He tells me I shall need to do neither. I shall be in some state of suspended animation, as far as I can make out. I can't understand him when he tries to describe it, but that's his affair. "Do you feel quite happy about it?" said I, for a sort of horror was beginning once more to creep over me. "If you mean, does my reason accept the view that he will, accidents apart, deliver me safe on the surface of Perelandra?" "The answer is yes," said Ransom. "If you mean, do my nerves and my imagination respond to this view?" "I'm afraid the answer is no. One can believe in anesthetics and yet feel in a panic when they actually put the mask over your face. I think I feel as a man who believes in the future life feels when he is taken out to face a firing party. Perhaps it's good practice." "And I'm to pack you into that accursed thing," said I. "Yes," said Ransom, "that's the first step. We must get out into the garden as soon as the sun is up and point it so that there are no trees or buildings in the way. Across the cabbage bed will do. Then I get in, with a bandage across my eyes, for those walls won't keep out all the sunlight once I'm beyond air, and you screw me down. After that, I think you'll just see it glide off." "And then?" "Well, then comes the difficult part. You must hold yourself in readiness to come down here again the moment you are summoned to take off the lid and let me out when I return." "When do you expect to return?" "Well, nobody can say. 6 months, a year, 20 years. That's the trouble. I'm afraid I'm laying a pretty heavy burden on you. I might be dead." "I know. I'm afraid part of your burden is to select a successor. At once, too. There are 4 or 5 people whom we can trust." "What will the summons be?" "Oyasa will give it. It won't be mistakable for anything else. You needn't bother about that side of it. One other point. I've no particular reason to suppose I shall come back wounded, but just in case, if you can find a doctor whom we can let into the secret, it might be just as well to bring him with you when you come down to let me out." "Would Humphrey do?" "The very man. And now for some more personal matters. I've had to leave you out of my will, and I'd like you to know why." "Oh, my dear chap, I never thought about your will till this moment." "Of course not. But I'd like to have left you something. The reason I haven't is this. I'm going to disappear. It is possible I may not come back. It's just conceivable there might be a murder trial, and if so, one can't be too careful. I mean, for your sake. And now for 1 or 2 other private arrangements." We laid our heads together, and for a long time we talked about those matters which one usually discusses with relatives and not with friends. I got to know a lot more about Ransom than I had known before, and from the number of odd people whom he recommended to my care, if ever I happened to be able to do anything, I came to realize the extent and intimacy of his charities. With every sentence, the shadow of approaching separation and a kind of graveyard gloom began to settle more emphatically upon us. I found myself noticing and loving all sorts of little mannerisms and expressions in him, such as we notice always in a woman we love, but notice in a man only as the last hours of his leave run out, or the date of the probably fatal operation draws near. I felt our nature's incurable incredulity, and could hardly believe that what was now so close, so tangible, and, in a sense, so much at my command, would in a few hours be wholly inaccessible, an image, soon even an elusive image, in my memory. And finally, a sort of shyness fell between us, because each knew what the other was feeling. It had got very cold. "We must be going soon," said Ransom. "Well, not till the Oyasa comes back," said I, though indeed, now that the thing was so near, I wished it to be over. "He has never left us," said Ransom. "He has been in the cottage all the time." "You mean he has been waiting in the next room all these hours?" "Oh, not waiting. They never have that experience. You and I are conscious of waiting because we have a body that grows tired or restless, and therefore a sense of cumulative duration. Also, we can distinguish duties and spare time, and therefore have a conception of leisure. It is not like that with him. He has been here all this time, but you can no more call it waiting than you can call the whole of his existence waiting. You might as well say that a tree in the wood was waiting, or the sunlight waiting on the side of a hill. Ransom yawned. I'm tired, he said, and so are you. I shall sleep well in that coffin of mine. Come, let us lug it out. We went into the next room, and I was made to stand before the featureless flame which did not wait, but just was, and there, with Ransom as our interpreter, I was in some fashion presented, and with my own tongue sworn in to this great business. Then we took down the blackout and let in the grey, comfortless morning. Between us we carried out the casket and the lid, so cold they seemed to burn our fingers. There was a heavy dew on the grass, and my feet were soaked through at once. The Eldil was with us, outside there, on the little lawn, hardly visible to my eyes at all in the daylight. Ransom showed me the clasps of the lid and how it was to be fastened on, and then there was some miserable hanging about, and then the final moment when he went back into the house and reappeared, naked, a tall, white, shivering, weary scarecrow of a man at that pale, raw hour. When he had got into the hideous box, he made me tie a thick black bandage round his eyes and head. Then he lay down. I had no thoughts of the planet Venus now, and no real belief that I should see him again. If I had dared, I would have gone back on the whole scheme. But the other thing, the creature that did not wait, was there, and the fear of it was upon me. With feelings that have since often returned to me in nightmare, I fastened the cold lid down on top of the living man and stood back. Next moment I was alone. I didn't see how it went. I went back indoors and was sick. A few hours later I shut up the cottage and returned to Oxford. Then the months went past, and grew to a year, and a little more than a year, and we had raids and bad news and hopes deferred, and all the earth became full of darkness and cruel habitations, till the night when Oyarsa came to me again. After that there was a journey in haste for Humphrey and me, standings in crowded corridors and waitings at small hours on windy platforms, and finally the moment when we stood in clear early sunlight in the little wilderness of deep weeds which Ransom's garden had now become, and saw a black speck against the sunrise, and then, almost silently, the casket had glided down between us. We flung ourselves upon it, and had the lid off in about a minute and a half. "Good God! All smashed to bits!" I cried at my first glance of the interior. "Wait a moment," said Humphrey. And as he spoke, the figure in the coffin began to stir, and then sat up, shaking off as it did so a mass of red things which had covered its head and shoulders, and which I had momentarily mistaken for ruin and blood. As they streamed off him and were caught in the wind, I perceived them to be flowers. He blinked for a second or so, then called us by our names, gave each of us a hand, and stepped out on the grass. "How are you both?" he said. "You're looking rather knocked up." I was silent for a moment, astonished at the form which had risen from that narrow house. Almost a new Ransom, glowing with health and rounded with muscle, and seemingly 10 years younger. In the old days he had been beginning to show a few grey hairs, but now the beard which swept his chest was pure gold. "Hello, you've cut your foot," said Humphrey, and I saw now that Ransom was bleeding from the heel. "Oh, it's cold down here," said Ransom. "I hope you've got the boiler going and some hot water and some clothes." "Yes," said I, as we followed him into the house. Humphrey thought of all that. I'm afraid I shouldn't have. Ransom was now in the bathroom, with the door open, veiled in clouds of steam, and Humphrey and I were talking to him from the landing. Our questions were more numerous than he could answer. "That idea of Schiaparelli's is all wrong," he shouted. "They have an ordinary day and night there. And, no, my heel doesn't hurt, or at least it's only just begun to. And, thanks, any old clothes, leave them on the chair. And, no thanks, I don't somehow feel like bacon or eggs or anything of that kind. No fruit, you say? Oh, well, no matter. Bread or porridge or something. And I'll be down in 5 minutes now." He kept on asking if we were really all right, and seemed to think we looked ill. I went down to get the breakfast, and Humphrey said he would stay and examine and dress the cut on Ransom's heel. When he rejoined me, I was looking at one of the red petals which had come in the casket. "That's rather a beautiful flower," said I, handing it to him. "Yes," said Humphrey, studying it with the hands and eyes of a scientist. "What extraordinary delicacy. Makes an English violet seem like a coarse weed. Well, let's put some of them in water. Well, not much good. Look, it's withered already. How do you think he is? Oh, tip-top in general. But I don't quite like that heel. He says the hemorrhage has been going on for a long time. Ransom joined us, fully dressed, and I poured out the tea. And all that day and far into the night he told us the story that follows. Chapter 3. What it is like to travel in a celestial coffin was a thing that Ransom never described. He said he couldn't. But odd hints about that journey have come out at one time or another when he was talking of quite different matters. According to his own account, he was not what we call conscious, and yet at the same time the experience was a very positive one, with a quality of its own. On one occasion, someone had been talking about seeing life in the popular sense of knocking about the world and getting to know people, and B, who was present, and who is an anthroposophist, said something I can't quite remember about seeing life in a very different sense. I think he was referring to some system of meditation which claimed to make the form of life itself visible to the inner eye. At any rate, Ransom let himself in for a long cross-examination by failing to conceal the fact that he attached some very definite idea to this. He even went so far, under extreme pressure, as to say that life appeared to him in that condition as a coloured shape. Asked what colour, he gave a curious look and could only say, "What colours? Yes, what colours?" But then he spoiled it all by adding, "Of course it wasn't colour at all, really, I mean not what we'd call colour," and shutting up completely for the rest of the evening. Another hint came out when a sceptical friend of ours called McPhee was arguing against the Christian doctrine of the resurrection of the human body. I was his victim at the moment, and he was pressing on me in his Scots way with such questions as, "So you think you're going to have guts and palate forever in a world where there'll be no eating, and genital organs in a world without copulation? Man, you'll have a grand time of it." When Ransom suddenly burst out with great excitement, "Oh, don't you see, you ass, that there's a difference between a trans-sensuous life and a non-sensuous life?" That, of course, directed McPhee's fire to him. What emerged was that in Ransom's opinion, the present functions and appetites of the body would disappear, not because they were atrophied, but because they were, as he said, engulfed. He used the word transsexual, I remember, and began to hunt about for some similar words to apply to eating, after rejecting trans-gastronomic, and since he was not the only philologist present, that diverted the conversation into different channels. But I am pretty sure he was thinking of something he had experienced on his voyage to Venus. But perhaps the most mysterious thing he ever said about it was this. I was questioning him on the subject, which he doesn't often allow, and had incautiously